Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Welcome back to the Cosmology and Science Podcast, where we look at new discoveries in science and inquiries into the beginnings and nature of the cosmos. Thanks for tuning in and enjoy the show. All right, so welcome back, everybody. And we have now a new episode with our recurring guest, or at least returning guest, Chris Brown. He is a cosmologist, independent cosmologist from Georgia in the United States. So, Chris, welcome back to the podcast.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
I am good. It's kind of a heat wave here in England, so it's fun. And we have the jubilee for the Queen, 70 years as Queen. So that's
wow! The whole
just it's decorated. Yeah, it's really really nice.
Is that a record?
That's a good question. It might.
It sounds like a record.
At least one of the longest reigning royals, Queen, King. Yeah. So, and everyone is so supportive and everybody loves the Queen. And I think also she's fantastic. So that's a kind of a festival feeling here. Yeah, how about Georgia? Is it warm there?
It is. Today is a beautiful day, but it is starting to get warm. It'll get deathly warm here in another month. I just planted my garden and I was walking around it yesterday and I was just covered in sweat, and I'm like, uh-oh. But it, you know, in the mornings it gets cool at night. It gets like down to like 55 or 60, and my dog is underneath my feet, so hopefully he will, if you hear breathing, that's him. But anyways, yeah, it is getting it is getting crazy warm.
Yeah, can you see the stars at night still, or how's that?
Yeah, I mean, I have pretty good the trees. The trees block my view, but if I go to, like, say, in my garden, I can see pretty well. There's still a lot of light pollution. I live in the middle of nowhere, but the closest town is like 20 miles or something. It's a pretty big town, and so there's a lot of light pollution from that. But the best night that I've ever seen. Now I've been to a lot of different places. Like I was in Kyrgyzstan for a little while, and I've been out in the Western United States quite a bit, in like Wyoming and Idaho, and done some stargazing. And the best place that I've ever seen it was here locally one night. And it was just a perfect condition night. We were in a boat on the lake, and it was absolutely breathtaking. I mean, like it was at a level that I have never other, like there is no other experience that come close to that as far as stargazing. Like like it was impressive that night. And I don't like ever, like there was like four of us on the boat and we all agreed. We were there for hours. We were just like, what in the world? Like the stars are crazy looking tonight, you know? And so I don't know what it was about the conditions that night, but it was impressive. You know?
I've had one night up here that I think it was after 3 or 4 weeks of constant kind of overcast. And the atmosphere was full of stuff, and then suddenly it just all cleared out. And maybe it was something similar, but it just felt like there was nothing between. I kind of, you saw 100% clarity straight out of the atmosphere, and then it's like all the stars were bigger and closer. It was kind of scary and breathtaking and immensely beautiful at the same time.
Yeah, there's something kind of thrilling about it when you experience it, you know.
So
I wonder how it looked, you know, 10,000 years ago or something.
Well, I had a another tangent on the side there, but one of my most beautiful moments with the stars was actually in the southern part of Italy. There's a place called Paestum, which is a bit south of Naples, where you have the Greek temples. It was a big city in the Magna Graecia, as they call it, like the big Greece in the ancient times. So they built temples there. And I came there late at night, and it's in the middle of nowhere. And yeah, I just saw this Greek temple, and I looked up and looked at the stars. And it was so kind of like goosebumps still, because it was just, I saw the same starry like night sky as the Greek philosophers, and maybe Plato and Aristotle were even there. So that's that was a connection with the clarity and kind of how close the stars were for ancient people as well. I thought we're going to today talk a bit like following up from our last talk, which is about 1.5 years ago. We went through much of cosmology and gravitational redshift, and perhaps then having some questions about the idea of expanding space and also other parts of the cosmology. So, but there are a couple of new things. And one of the things I've noticed now, or was made aware of, was the part with surface brightness on distant galaxies. Both through, you sent me a paper from Eric Lerner, and then I started reading a paper from Hubble, the person Hubble, where he talks about the surface brightness, and that if the galaxies are moving away from us, they should have less surface brightness. And then Lerner is concluding that this is not the case. So do you have any thoughts about this? Have you looked deeper into this?
You know, when I wrote my book, I researched this pretty, like, I remember researching this and finding that there was like, it was almost like it was, everybody was in agreement that the Tolman test or something like that, that all of the Tolman tests mm-hmm. had concluded that it was matched with an expanding universe. Which that's to me I thought that they had concluded. And so like I didn't know, when you look into it, it's a little weird because they do like the evolution of galaxies and they change it, you know, and it's a little hard to follow. But You are absolutely right that this is kind of a newer development, because like now the landscape, when you research it, all you find is Lerner stuff. Like it's everywhere. Uh-huh. If like I just searched for surface brightness, expanding universe, and almost everything was, you know, saying that it was usually Lerner's papers. There's several. I didn't know that he had published so many papers. Now there may have just been like two or three, and then they're republished and stuff. But there was like the one from 2018 that's in, you know, that the, what is that, the I forget the journal, but
this is the one in the the Royal Astronomical Society, published by Oxford University Press.
Yeah,
so that seems kind of established.
I think that may be the best paper. That may not be the leading journal for that field. The thing is that it seems like they're looking at it differently. Now there was a few other papers from the other side, from the Lambda team, Team Lambda, that that were like, they were basically saying that the Tolman test is not really a good test for deciding whether it's an expanding or non-expanding universe. And that's changed, you know. And the reason is, and they're kind of right. Like, it's like, yeah, sure, Lerner is showing that the expanding paradigm doesn't really fit with the Tolman test. But the thing is that it's like, as you get further and further away, if it's less reliable, you know, because of, there is like some sort of adjustments you have to make for the evolution of a galaxy. And I'm actually not quite sure what the difference between the evolution of a galaxy and an expanding universe and a non-expanding universe, but there's definitely going to be differences there. Mm-hmm. And so it's not that it's It's an interesting point, because it's like they used to use it as one of the verifications that it was an expanding universe, and now Lerner, it seems like they've changed it to where it seems like the biggest objection is that it's not that good of a test.
And now they're dismissing the Tolman test because they say it's so old and that we have now better ways of establishing the fact that they are moving away. So they're kind of dismissing the test since his results are not conforming to their models fully. There's for listeners as well here. So what Eric Lerner is doing in his papers is just showing that the distant galaxies should be dimmed compared if they are moving compared to if they're not moving. And then with his research, he's showing that they're not dimmed, and they conclude that it's a fully Euclidean cosmos that we're watching, looking at, and that they're not expanding, they're not moving. So it would be interesting to see if there's any other response.
Yeah, it seems like on
the data and on the math. Also.
Lerner seems to be well respected in the establishment, which is kind of interesting to there has been, that's all of science, there's all these rogues, that's it's always a rogue, and then they end up adopting the rogue the Lerner has something else that I noticed. I don't know if there's a paper published on this, but which I thought it was kind of interesting. There's the anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background radiation. And that's basically just the irregularities, you know, it's not quite perfectly smooth or all the same color, you know, if you will. He showed that it was in line with our Milky Way galaxy, the reason that it was, there's this pattern to it. It was because the pattern is parallel with the plane of the Milky Way galaxy. And so that should not be the case at all. if it was from the Big Bang, that, you know, then there would be no relation to the Milky Way.
That's interesting. If the background radiation is, I was making a list to a friend the other day because we talked about this, and just summing up some of the points that if the space is expanding, then space should be stretched in the cosmos. We should have a curved geometry in the cosmos, but it's not. It's Euclidean and it's flat, which they call the flatness problem, which is acknowledged by everyone. And then space should, if it's expanding, it should also be expanding in galaxies, but it's not. It's just expanding then, according to the models, then between the galaxies, which is also a bit strange. And then the third point was this with the receding galaxies, that you should have a dimmer surface brightness. And then according to Lerner, at least, and the people he worked with, it's not. And then the last point was that distant galaxies, if they're especially like 13 billion light years away, that should be 13 billion light years in the past. And then we should be looking at a very young kind of infant universe. But what the Hubble telescope found as well is, like the current one, is we found big and matured galaxies, which is very hard to reconcile with the time scale that they developed in such a short time. So it's just out of those four points, the surface brightness is interesting to look into.
The thing that I've been saying since I've started this stupid quest is that you have to, it doesn't matter what data you use. It doesn't matter what test you use or what journal you publish in, even. There is no changing it until you change. It's like you have to change the messaging somehow in a way that shifts the culture of the community, because the evidence is overwhelming that the Lambda paradigm is wrong. Lerner showed, like, I watched a quick YouTube video of Lerner, and he was showing some slides, and he showed that the predictions versus observation were more accurate in the beginning, or like early on, and then as the years progress, the model fails to predict, you know, data worse and worse. The failure rate gets worse through the years, but until you have, you know, an obvious explanation for the redshift, then you can't, like, there's, you know, that's the most important thing. But it's also, I don't think that there was ever like the expanding paradigm was ever an accurate way of doing cosmology, because there's the basic cosmology, it's called the cosmological principle. It's like the most fundamental way of looking at it, at the universe. So you expect the universe to be kind of the same no matter where you're at. But it also, it should also mean no matter when you're at, because in the future, in the you know, like a civilization, say in a trillion years from now, they're not even going to be able to see any other galaxies. They're going to be in their own galaxy, and the galaxy is going to be so distant that they won't be able to see them in the sky. And that's, you know, like, how are they going to know that the universe expanded to where they are? And so that's like, why aren't we in that? Because in the realm of all possibilities, you would expect that there'd be more civilizations during that time if they can exist. And so why are we just the law of averages? You would expect where there's no other galaxies except for the Milky Way. Like it's such a weird thing, a paradigm is, especially in cosmology. Cosmology is, I don't know why it's so much different than the rest of the sciences.
I guess it's because it's a subject that we don't, we're not even sure what we are talking about. We don't know the size, even if you think expanding space and Big Bang, we have no idea how big it is beyond the visible boundaries. So we're making complete conclusions of, maybe we might be looking at 1% of the totality, or maybe 1 trillionth or a trillionth of the totality of the total universe, but we're still trying to make conclusive models based on, I tried to make another like comparison the other day, which, like, if you grow up in the desert and all you see is the desert, and then you conclude that the whole planet is a desert, that's a little bit like, since we only can see 3.7 billion light years out, it becomes guesswork to some extent.
So it's all guesswork. Cosmology is all guesswork.
But it's also like,
you know, I think that humility is the best approach, but it's hard for me to be humble. And so I can understand their reasons. Like, I don't want to be humble when I oppose the expanding universe. For me, the idea doesn't make sense because there is no reason. Like, there's no, like, you have gravity. That would mean that there's the effects of gravity throughout the universe, whatever that means. But there is nothing for expanding universe. It's just an observation thing that they, it's a redshift anomaly is what it is. I think it's just gravitational redshift. That, you know, I find the, Milton Mordheim, I hope I'm saying that right, the Mond paradigm, I find that is, like, exactly the right approach, almost. Like, it's almost identical to say that there's a minimum acceleration. And so I didn't know this, but I was reading one of his papers, like, you know, just a couple months ago, and I stumbled across it, and I'm like, oh wow, his work is so similar to mine, because he was saying that there should, he just didn't go, he needs, Milton should take it a step further and just say that there's, the universe has a minimum acceleration. It's not necessarily a modification to Newtonian dynamics. It's just that the classic Newtonian dynamics was wrong, because there's objects are embedded within one another. So there is nothing that has its own parameters. You can't say this star has this amount of gravity, because you have to include, you know, the observer's relationship, or whatever object you're discussing in relationship to that star.
Yeah. Well, you could say it at the surface of the star, you could say it has this, like if you're standing on the surface.
Right. But, yeah, but what is the surface? Like, okay, you know, that's a particular, you're saying, then it's, you know, actually it's what you're saying at the surface is this distance from the center.
Yeah, that's true. Just partly just for listeners, just to make the distinction that, like, when we're talking about here, the difference between the gravity of, like, the gravity that causes a redshift if you're standing next to a galaxy, or if you're standing 13 billion years, light years away from a galaxy, then the whole mass is a very different, like, at that distance, the mass you have to take into account is enormous. It's this kind of enormous sphere with the galaxy in the center and us at the radius. So... this is one of the main points in the book, but I just, for people listening.
There's still a problem with the term surface gravity, because even surface gravity, like, everyone knows what you're talking about with the surface gravity. It's the visible surface. Okay, yeah, sure. I'm fine with that, but you still have a relational problem, because the surface gravity of the star at the surface is X amount. But when it's when you're far, far away to where it's embedded in a galaxy that's embedded in a cluster of galaxies, then, you know, the surface gravity would appear differently from, you know, the perspective of another person, because there's a minimum acceleration from the parent objects that adds to the surface gravity. And so if you just expand that outward, because filaments, there's, you know, you have clusters of galaxies, then you have, I think they call them filaments and veins. Mm-hmm. You know, the universe is kind of a grid like structure. And so these parent, these larger macro structures create a minimum acceleration depending on the perspective, which means you have to use distance to determine the distance the star, the light has traveled to determine the amount of gravitational redshift. And so that's why you can eliminate Hubble. And so we've already discussed that, but the thing that I found interesting was that Milton has never had taken it to the next level. He's always talked about, you know, usually it's a description of dark matter and dark energy. And so that minimum acceleration comes into play there, but it should also come into play with gravitational redshift.
Yeah. So, I just pulled up here like a quote from Hubble when it comes to redshift. He wrote a paper in 1947 for the Astronomical Society of the Pacific, and he says there, when, like, there's some indications that there are other forces, other reasons for the redshift, and then he says that it seems likely that redshifts may not be due to an expanding universe, and much of the current speculation on the structure of the universe may require re-examination. That was his own words, and in 1947. So.
And that was way significantly later.
Yeah, then when it's like that's 25 years later. So he's still very cautious about this. This is also, the paper is part of an argument to build a 200-inch telescope. And he was using a 100-inch at the time. So this is also interesting. He could see just half a billion light years out. And then he wanted 200 inch so he could see 1 billion light years out. And now we see 13 and a half or so billion light years out. So he looked at a smaller part, smaller sphere into the universe.
You know, those early guys, all of the people, see, the early 20th century had some of the brightest physicists ever, like not just Einstein. I mean, there was all kinds of, like, Alfred Whitehead, Poincare. You know, there was just so many brilliant mathematicians and physicists in the beginning of, and they really were reluctant to adapt the expanding paradigm. In fact, I think the biggest proponent of the expanding paradigm was Lemaître, and I think he was a Jesuit priest, you know. And I'm not saying that influenced the work, but I think that's, you know, like, that's just a fact that people should know, and that it took those other brilliant minds a long time to adapt the expanding paradigm. And some of them never did, you know, like Fritz Zwicky fought his whole life against it. I'm fairly sure I could be wrong about that. For some reason, I get him and another guy mixed up. But anyways, there were several opponents that were brilliant people in the beginning. It's only now that, I mean, there's a lot of brilliant opponents that's always been against it, but it, you know, in mainstream academia where the professors are teaching, like, you know, pretty much all of them are teaching the expanding paradigm at a university level.
Yeah.
And I think it's sad, you know.
I think a lot of them in private would tell you that, like, yeah, there's big problems. Like, there are some issues with this, with this whole framework of, like, for the model. But what you said earlier, I just want to repeat that. Like, so the Big Bang Theory is made by a Belgian Catholic Jesuit priest, Lemaître. And he bases it, like, it is Genesis. Like, let there be light, and then creation comes into being. And he's also Thomas Aquinas with the whole idea of that the divine creates the cosmos out of nothing. So he takes kind of two of the biggest explanatory models in Catholicism and uses that as a ground for his model, or he kind of merges that together with the expanding space and then takes it backwards. So I think it's absolutely a good point. And also, if nothing else, when people think that religion and science is always in conflict,
that's the entire reason for the scientific method is so you don't have human bias in the data and knowledge you gain.
If you go a bit back in time, it's more like the idea that the divine created an intelligible cosmos, and then we as humans can try to understand how it was all made. But it's very much in harmony with their religious beliefs back, just 100 years ago, and then for centuries before that. So that's kind of an argument from the other side, not that you discredit the Big Bang Theory because it was made by a religion person, but you can also then see that it's actually, but it's a different topic though. But
I almost think that it's more of an indication of, say, the primitive nature of men at that time, because, or of Lemaître, say, in that they didn't quite grasp the infinite. To me, an infinite universe would be more indicative of a creator than a finite universe. Finite universe just doesn't, I don't know. Like, it just...
That's very interesting. Yeah, so it brings us to the next point I had on the list, which is that I've been studying and looking into the brain hemispheres and the work of Ian McGilchrist. He's a British psychiatrist and a writer and philosopher, and he wrote The Emissary and The Master and His Emissary in 2009, and then he wrote a new book now, The Matter with Things. And he just goes through all the brain science, so that we have two different brains, essentially. They're connected, but you can also split them completely, as they do with epilepsy patients, and then you have kind of two independent brains. And also, this connection between the brains is mostly just limiting the signals back and forth. So, and if you look into this, you start seeing how you, in some sense, have two different ways of thinking about the world and apprehending the world, and also creating models. And then the Big Bang Theory is very much a left hemisphere type mm-hmm. of thinking, which is you analyze things into bits and then you build up a model, but you also, you grasp for full control and certainty about everything. Your right brain doesn't work like that. The right brain is very relaxed with ambiguities and with uncertainties. And it sees, it approaches things from a holistic, more just like perceptive, like way of apprehending and being. So the infinite is very problematic for the left hemisphere or the left brain to grasp with. And so what you said was exactly the thing I've been pondering for a few weeks, that there's an enormous resistance to leaving the Big Bang model because it's so beautiful in the way that it creates total certainty and it explains everything. Because then the alternative is that, well, we are floating around in a stable Euclidean cosmos where we can only see a certain radius, but it's most likely infinitely big and infinitely old. So it's not very exciting news either. So then people would rather stick with the model we have. I think that's a part of it.
And I think that's one of the reasons that dark energy and dark matter will never go away is because it's something that's mysterious. It's like we love a mystery. And I think the Big Bang is kind of like that, you know?
Yeah.
It's like all the same. It's like the same thing.
But if you come, you know, you come into the marketplace of ideas and say, oh, listen up, everybody. The cosmos is we living in an exploding cosmos, exploding universe out of nothing. And then that is very attractive and fascinating.
So unfortunately, if you sit down and try to give it some logic thought, then the story is ugly. Like I personally despise the idea that the universe came from nothing, because it's just this non-meaningful answer. Whereas an infinite universe in all directions, it's like, okay, so we have to conquer what that means before we can move on to where we, you know.
Yeah,
on to something else.
Well, there's another aspect with, well, in general, paradigm shifts, but also especially scientific paradigms, I think, because to change your mind, you need a certain openness and maybe some like creativity, and that you kind of embrace this unknown and the adventure and exploration of something unknown. Which is not usually how scientific thinking works. You're kind of driving in the opposite direction usually with like scientific endeavors. So kind of to leave something behind and embrace something, a new journey is, I think, is harder in some scientific areas than others.
I also think that there's a major issue that hardly anyone has addressed, is and that science on like a global scale is a little weird to say that there's a consensus. You know, there's certain things that you can say that there's a consensus paradigm, but there's still a good chance that the consensus paradigm is wrong, especially on minor details or in major details. And so it really just all depends on who's controlling the voice. And so that may be the thing that we have with the expanding paradigm. You know, of course, the universities are the most important people. Like if you have people in every place at the university teaching the expanding paradigm, then that means that there's, you could kind of say that there's a consensus, but there's a lot into the culture and not the science is what I'm saying.
Yeah, but it's interesting. I had a look at the Wikipedia page on Big Bang in different languages, and it's presented very differently. So like if you look at the Italian version, they're much more saying that this is the like the predominant model, but it has several issues with it. There's several open questions, but it's kind of based on what we see. There are like a majority is leaning towards that this might be true. But then if you go to the English one, it says more like this is essentially universally accepted now, which is just not right. So it depends on which language sphere you're in as well, like how. Definitive it's presented.
You know, I think one of the problems is who is the guy that we were talking about not, it wasn't Lerner. It was, there was another guy we were talking about. It was the ether guy. What is his name?
Yes.
I forget his
name. Glenn Burke.
Yeah, his last name is hard to pronounce. Glenn. I call him Glenn. Yeah. But yeah, that guy, look, I'm, you know, God bless him because he's a static universe guy. These are my people. But the thing is the alternative cosmology crowd doesn't always subscribe to the same things. It's not just that it's expanding versus non-expanding. You know, you have general relativity. There's all these points of contention in physics, and it's kind of hard to get everybody on the same page. And so that's why you want to influence the people that believe in the expanding paradigm, is because honestly, I think general relativity is one of the greatest accomplishments in physics ever, if not the greatest. Like, general relativity is basically an explanation of the universe. I think that it's not just an explanation of gravity. Like these tensors that he's using, that Einstein used to demonstrate gravity, the impact on the coordinates around them. I guess that's how you describe general relativity. These tensors are the universe. It's like how the universe behaves. And it's, I think that Glenn is kind of right in that the mainstream has this wrong view of space-time, and that it is more like an ether. I think that it's not more like an ether. It's kind of like ether is the wrong word. I think space-time is the right word, but the space-time needs to be understood as containing mass, because they're not, mass and space-time are not separatable entities. They are intertwined with one another. And these tensors are representative of that. These, you know, like you have the Minkowski metric, is this, it's like, it's a set, there's a whole bunch of equations and indices and components and stuff within these metric tensors. But they all add, it's the pieces of the universe. And I think that that's the right approach. A geometrical approach is the right approach. And so there's, you know, I would condemn Glenn in saying that we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like this mathematical approach is exactly right with our universe. And I actually think that's what Gregory Perelman showed when he resolved the Poincaré conjecture, because it's like you're talking about the most fundamental aspects. It's not just a single point in space. No, it's more than that, because it's a single point in the universe. And what does that mean? There's, you know, it's not independent from the rest of the universe. So the universe behaves, it's kind of like this three sphere where, you know, you have all of these points of gravity. You know, some are small, some are big, but they're all part of the same system. And it's this thing, and it can be expressed using, you know, differential geometry. And,
Yeah. So you're bringing up all the things that is going to be the topic now, like your ideas about space, time, gravity, and mass. I just wanted to slip in, wrap up. 2 points. One is that the thing you said now about alternative, or I like to point out that expanding space, you can question that, or astrophysics as a field, as far as I've looked into it, is excellent.
Excellent.
It's super detailed. It's super thorough. It's based on observable facts. It's excellent. Cell biology, molecular biology, the nanomachines and the DNA coding within the cell is also excellent, brilliant research. It's a super good scientific field. But if you look at those two as an example, and then you move over to cosmology, then it's a whole different... So just to avoid people thinking that you're questioning everything in science, it's not like that
exactly.
At all. It's just that there's something... This expanding space thing is something very unique. So that's one thing. And I just wanted to say that the last part of Hubble's paper from 1947 is just a beautiful kind of, it's a very British way of concluding as well, because he wants to have this new telescope. He can see twice as far into the universe. And he just says that as the darkness is pushed back, greater problems will doubtless emerge, which we cannot now foresee.
You know,
that's a bit of this humble.
Even cosmology is an excellent field, especially when you're talking about like galaxies that are very nearby, and you know, definitely dynamics of star systems and things like that. It's just when you get to talking about origins, and you know, of course, the Doppler interpretation, I think, is just a giant mistake. Yeah. But I think that it will be realized. There is new research that is, you know, was published recently where they were talking about large scale gravitational coherence or something like that. I forget exactly what the paper was. I actually looked for it a few weeks ago and I couldn't find it. But I remember seeing it in headlines. It made its rounds through the media, where there's these large scale structures that a cosmologist haven't quite realized. And when that catches on, all they have to do, I mean, they're so close to realizing that that's the key to their paradigm, is that they're not realizing that objects are embedded within larger scale structures. And so that there's a lot more gravitational impacts than they're letting on.
Yeah. You said something great earlier about how like the evidence is mounting. It's just with back to Lerner for a second. He is so patient in his work, and then he wrote the book 30 years ago, which is called "The Big Bang Never Happened." But one of his conclusions is that the more observations, the better equipment we're going to get. The more we're going to see that it doesn't make sense. So he's just taking this really laid back approach and just like, let's just time work for us, and then it would just crumble eventually. And then he's kind of working on, I guess, both like alternatives and then a little bit showing the problem. So so it's the last decade has also been kind of many observations. You had the one star in the Milky Way that was then first seen to be older than the whole universe. And then that was a huge problem. And then they just kept making measurements until they found one measurement that that was more in favor of it being a bit younger. And then they changed the estimation model for the age. And then suddenly it fit. And it was just 13 billion years old and not 16 billion years old. Or something.
You know, that technological...
But you can't do that forever.
That technological progression.
Fudging things into the model.
That technological progression that... is that you were talking about with Lerner, where we're not just that, but it's just the observational thing where we're going to get better and better, and it's going to eventually show the expanding paradigm. That's the only reason that I'm even doing what I'm doing, is because that sort of thing it gives me hope. Like there's it's going to change for sure. Like things are going to change. When I was in school, I think I was in like fifth or sixth grade, and our science teacher was talking about the Milky Way, and he told us, he was talking about black holes, and we had just talked about the Milky Way. And I asked my teacher if there was a black hole in the middle of the Milky Way. And he said, no, there's no black hole in the middle of the Milky Way. And I was like, there should be, because that's the center of the galaxy. And he said, no, there's not. And now we know that there's a supermassive black hole in the middle of the Milky Way. And in fact, there's probably a supermassive black hole in the middle of every spiral galaxy. And, you know, I knew this in fifth grade just because like it was just intuitive, but the mainstream it took a long time for the mainstream to kind of come to terms with things. And it's not necessarily, like I say, the scientific thing. It's just that there's a cultural element to these big changes to stuff like the Big Bang. But the evidence is seemingly overwhelmingly in favor of a non-expanding paradigm.
I've heard children have the same intuitive question when they can be like 7, 8 years old, and they say that, well, the moon is going around the earth is going around the sun. And then the question is like, well, what is the sun and the solar system? What is that going around? And it's like, well, nothing. It's just kind of floating around. It's like, but then suddenly we know, well, it's going, it is going in orbit around a black hole in the center. So then you might ask, what is the galaxy going around? But then maybe that's something, maybe there's something super massive in the center of the clusters, for example. But since we mentioned technology and like progress, this is a good place to just say a few things about the new telescope, since the Hubble telescope, and now you get a new one, the James Webb telescope, because that was shot up on Christmas Day, and it took about 1 month to get it into its orbit, and then now it has 6 months of calibrating things, and then it's going to start taking pictures just July or August this year, and that might be a huge kind of game changer in terms of what we can observe, especially at the outer edges of the observable cosmos. So there's a kind of a couple of cool facts also about it. Like the Hubble telescope is going around the Earth, and it takes about 95 minutes for one orbit around the Earth. It's only 500 kilometers away. So 500 kilometers. The James Webb telescope is going to be 1.5 million kilometers. So that one is placed like 4 times further out than the moon, and then it's going to go in an orbit around the sun. So that's going to be a whole different. We're going to get results that are very different compared to the Hubble telescope. So that's going to be very exciting. Like there might be new discoveries and observations just after the summer. That's going to be a huge problem. So that's a bit exciting in the sense.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it. That thing will probably open up a lot of new avenues. I heard that it was that like when they're looking at a galaxy at a very large distance with it, that it catches roughly one photon per second per galaxy. And I was like, really? That don't seem right. But I don't know if that was an accurate measurement or stat or not. But that didn't. I was like, that's kind of hard to comprehend that the galaxy is that. Takes up that tiny of an amount of space or has that brightness, that luminosity.
Like they don't even sound right, but like that would take a long time to be able to develop a view. It's kind of hard to comprehend, honestly. Like I really is. Like I expect it to be just like the Hubble Deep Field, you know, like just more galaxies that are old galaxies, you know.
Yeah.
And we'll see.
It could be for parts of the community, it might be a sigh of relief because you might have, we might get new pictures and observations that just resets big part of the field, like for cosmology. And then you also have a good reason to try to work on alternative models compared to the current one. It might be kind of a good sort of excuse to start working on other things.
Do you know what distances we're talking about here?
Well, light years, 13.5, 13.6, 13.7 billion light years.
So it's not, I mean, it's far, but it's not just ridiculously far.
True. It's funny, I still, a little throwback to the last episode we had, that it's interesting, like, the reason we can't see any further is if we have a stable universe with gravitational redshift being responsible for most or all of the redshift, it just means that the light waves can't travel further than 13.7 billion light years. So if we moved 5 billion light years in any direction, we would just move the kind of light bubble around us 5 billion light years, and then we still... Unless the density changes in that part of, if you move a little bit in the cosmos, then we will see exactly the same radius.
Yeah, but I mean, is there a way to make a telescope, say, to view 15? I mean, just like if you didn't view it, like say you didn't consider the gravitational redshift.
But the theory then would be that, or the... Like the expanding space theory is that we can't at 30.7, the galaxies are moving so fast away from us that the light will never reach us. So that's why we can't see any further. But if you think it's a stable universe and it's gravitational redshift, it's just that another galaxy might be just one, well, like just 200 million light years further out. There's just another galaxy floating in peace there. But that light will just stop. It will fade to nothing. 200 million light years from us.
I think there's also like there's something called Olber's paradox, and the Olber's paradox is actually an argument against a static universe and saying that, you know, all of the light would be the night sky would not be dark, it would be light because you could just see all the stars everywhere. And I think that actually comes into play when you're using a telescope, you know. Because, like, eventually there's going to be a galaxy in the way, and you know.
Yeah, but it's also the idea that we are not actively seeing into space; we're just receiving with more and more sensitivity. But then, no matter how much sensitivity and how much light you can take in, and as an observer, there's nothing to anything 15 billion light years. It's not the light. Will never reach us.
Yeah, there's like a hard limit at 13.7.
Yeah,
that's what I came up with. Also,
that's the reach of any galaxy. How far the light will go. That's the maximum distance for the light. And the redshift is because then at that point the redshift goes exponentially up to infinity. So it's just the light wave. Just it's like dropping. So if this way of thinking is right, it's like dropping a rock in the water, and then the ripple effects stretches out, and then eventually nothing. So it'll be the same idea for the light waves.
You'd have to send the telescope.
Exactly. Well, if you send the telescope 2 billion light years out, then that could look further. Or if you send it 1.7 billion light years out, then that could receive things from 13.7 from that point and send it further down to us. I mean, maybe I never thought about this. Maybe that's how, as a civilization, eventually you will expand your visual field of the universe, that you keep building kind of like boosters, light boosters or sensor machinery way, way out, and that keeps repeating. The light waves are kind of sending new signals, and then at the moment we can just, it's like we're living in this analog age where we can only see that far out, or we can only receive things from within that distance. But then if we move, we get kind of satellite telescopes, then we will gradually expand our visual field into the universe.
Yeah, you could use von Neumann. Probes, where it's basically just a self-replicating probe, you could actually explore the universe really quickly with a self-replicating, like especially if you could use, you know, comets or meteorites or asteroids to.
Yeah. You will have the delay though of 5 billion years if you put the probe out 5 billion years.
Yeah. But you know, for a civilization. That as long as you have a lasting civilization, that's the thing.
Yeah,
it's like okay, once you start a process like that, you just like we'll know the answer to whatever you're solving. But at least it doesn't matter if it takes 20,000 years or a million years or whatever.
Yeah, and if you look at it like holistically, not from the human perspective, but just like life, like emerging on planet Earth. And then expanding, it would be like an organic expansion of the reach of a species and of a civilization. So, like if you think of it more like from the outside. I wanted to, like, you started saying a lot of things about gravity and space-time and mass. And so you mentioned in one of the emails that you thought space and time and gravity and mass are in some sense the same. And that's an area I wanted to ask you about and just get to know more about your thoughts about this, how you view this as kind of these essential elements of the nature of cosmos itself.
Well, it's the it's like a metric tensor or a tensor. Like I was saying earlier, that I think a geometrical approach, you know, even if it is differential geometry and it's hard for everybody to comprehend and understand, but I do think that that is the right approach, because you can use math to describe the universe. That's the whole point, right, of physics, is to use math. I mean, in a way, to use math to add some structure to this, these laws that govern physics. And so space time, like when you're talking about general relativity and the types of mathematical entities in general relativity, you know, like they use these terms like space time and mass and gravity, curvature, you know, whatever. There's all these human words to describe it, but it's this, in the big picture, it's just this, it's like this mathematical system that has multiple components to it. And so that's what I mean, that space, time, gravity, mass, these are all the same thing. It's because there's an obvious difference between mass and empty space, but not when you really look. When you really look, empty space still has mass. Like everywhere you look, there is no empty space. There is no true vacuum, because even gravity permeates the vacuum. And gravity, as far as I know, has mass energy, you know, the equivalent to mass energy. Into just the curvature of space-time itself generates more mass. And so long as there's just a little bit of mass present, there's going to be more mass present because of the gravitational field of the universe. And so there really is no difference between space and mass. And I believe time is is just basically the motion of these things. Of course, time and space and mass and all these terms, They all have different meanings, and so it's kind of hard to communicate this, but time is basically the motion of mass. Motion is basically the coordinate system, the mass moving through the coordinate system. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like if you have something that describes the universe as a whole, something like general relativity, which doesn't really describe the universe as a whole, it just describes gravity. Gravity's impact to the space-time structure, but the universe as a whole, like on the large scale, the macro scale, gravity is the king. Gravity is what's controlling everything. And so that's why I say that it's all the same thing. It's because it's this idea of the metric tensor or whatever geometrical word or tensor you're going to use. More specifically, probably something like Ricci curvature tensor. This is an area that I don't know anything about this stuff. Like I'm basically an investigative reporter reporting from the outside in, because I mean, I grasp the concepts and I can follow them, but I am by no means some guy that just does differential geometry on the weekends, you know. However, from the outside in, looking in, it appears that there's this thing that's called the Ricci flow, or the Ricci flow. I've heard it pronounced both ways. And this is this thing that Gregory Perelman used to solve the Poincare conjecture. And so it's this flow through space, and it's a naturally occurring mathematical entity for differential geometry, kind of. Okay, this is, like I say, this is outside my realm. Like I should not be talking about this, but it's what it is. It's this tensor that smooths out irregularities in shapes, and so. For topology, in topology, they call the Ricci flow time, the flow of time. And so like it just allows you to, you can change the shape of objects using the Ricci flow. And so that's how Perelman was to prove the Poincare conjecture, which basically states that, I think it's like, any, I don't even know, it's something about simply connected objects and their like how they can morph into other objects. But the point is that it's this, okay, so you could say that the mathematics of what we call the coordinate system has gravity. That's kind of like the way that I'm understanding it. It's like the equations, the differential equations in topology kind of force gravity upon these topological objects. And you know, there's a proof of that. And so, you know, there's a guy named Richard Hamilton. I think his name's Richard Hamilton, but Hamiltonian mechanics. You've heard of this. Like, he did a lot of quantum mechanic type stuff, and he was a topologist. Anyways, he published basically this exact same thing, this Ricci flow, back in, you know, the 80s, sometime around the year I was born. And so this is not necessarily this bizarre concept. It's kind of something that's been explored for a while. And, it really comes from general relativity. This is basically the roots of it. And so that's what I mean, that it's all the same thing. You know, it's whatever you want to say. It's this tensor. And that's because this like, you can have a certain tensor to where it's not just the flow doesn't go to a certain direction with boundary conditions, like as in general relativity, when you're talking about the curvature of space-time around a massive object, there's a direction to the gravity for that massive object. But in general relativity, you have to describe these boundary conditions. Well, that's why the Ricci flow stuff, this stuff that I was just talking about with the Poincaré conjecture, that's why it may be more appropriate, is because there's not a specific, you don't have to have these boundary conditions for it. It's just this intrinsic property of whatever coordinate system you're working with that causes these, it smooths out irregularities. And that's basically gravity. It's just an intrinsic property of existence. Basically, just you could even say math, but math is just this demonstration of existence, you know.
I find this very fascinating because it's it kind of balances out what we said earlier, that like, well, maybe the static universe is a little bit boring, but then the stuff you're talking about now, maybe there are even more exciting, interesting things to discover once we can just move on also in cosmology and start looking at these, like the nature of gravity in itself. It also occurs to me, like, it's both Einstein and Stephen Hawking as well. Like, they end up with gravity as the big, that is the big one. Like, in Hawking's thinking is kind of, that's what sets it all into motion. That's kind of the first mover almost from Aristotle. Like, that's, is even in Dante, they have the same thing with, as it travels into the heavens and you get to the prime primo mobile, like the outer shell of them all, and just describes how it all starts, the whole cosmos starts with a little light beam coming from like the divine source and touching this big sphere, and then that starts spinning, and then that starts time in itself, and also then this gravity will be a part of like that, which is like even if it's not kind of the first thing in a sequence, it's the deeper thing that is creating some kind of energy or movement.
Yeah, like it's kind of hard to comprehend a universe without gravity. Like if you just stop and think, like if you remove gravity, what does the universe look like? Well, first of all, everything just separates. And so then it's like, okay, well, then what? And then nothing happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Nothing happens.
If you're not separate, it's just like it just stands still.
Gravity is time, you know, like it's basically the exact same thing. And, you know, it's what that is the motion of space or mass, vice versa, you know, like there's lots of different things there. But it's gravity is this thing that's like it affects. It's this single formula, you could say, that impacts every single square inch of the universe. You know, just according to the amount of mass in that square inch of the universe.
I mean, it's the more you think about it, the more mysterious it becomes. And even like Newton had wondered, how can it, what is this force that is instantly working on the moon, pulling it towards the Earth through empty space? And what is the nature of that force? How does it,
it's very bizarre.
How can it really work? Yeah. Also, that's definitely one area to keep looking into if the expanding space stuff is one day, let's say 10 years from now, it's kind of sorted or like settled for or like more or less kind of there's a shift in the view of it, then we should probably look more at the gravity. You also had like I think the last point on the list now was the ether, and then maybe that also goes into the gravity, but I was fascinated by reading about because it ties into the nature of a wave as well. This is another topic I talked with a good friend the other day, and then starting to think philosophically about what a wave is, like if you have a stadium, like a big like sports event, and everybody kind of gets up and down and creates the wave, like what is the wave in it? What is it that's moving? Like individuals are getting up and down, or you can say the same with water, for example, like water is just kind of waving up and down, but then the wave is moving, and then what is the wave in itself? And then that connected it back to how people have always thought that light as a wave needs a medium, because it's a wave, therefore it has to move through something. And then it was interesting to read about ether as an idea of kind of tiny particles that are just much, much smaller than atoms, but they are permeating everything in the universe. So and I think you had some thoughts about that as well.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if particles is the right word, and I don't know if ether is the right word. I think that it's just, you just have to understand that the metric, the space-time coordinate system is mass.
Yeah.
You know, it is mass, and that, because otherwise, where does mass get introduced? You know, it gets introduced through these tensors that you use in general relativity. And I think that that's just because it's a primitive mathematical description. It's a primitive approach to resolving gravity. You have to define the boundaries for the objects you're talking about in general relativity. And so these, I think that, you know, you could say particles, and you can say the particles of mass, and that's fine, but you know, like the word, like it's just the word particle, you're supposed to mean, it's supposed to mean that it's a, say, a spherical structure, but this is just a shortcut in physics. There's this joke that I tell, I wrote it in my book, and I've told it several times, but where the there's a farmer that hold on 1 second, do you know what I'm talking about? This the farmer and the physicist joke where there's spherical cows, the spherical cow joke.
I heard
you know, where, you know, he says, like, the farmer asks the physicist a question, he's like, and the physicist gives him a response, and he's like, but this only, here's my solution, but this only works for spherical cows in a vacuum.
Yeah.
It's because physicists use this way of describing things. They just narrow everything down to this motionless, spinless sphere. Yeah. And, you know, that's basically what a particle is. And so you could say bit, you know, a bit of mass. But I think it's just better to say that the whole thing is mass, and then it's all divided. So really it's like you could just have all of the universe, in all of the mass of the universe is one, and then divided by whatever part, you know. And so that would be, instead of having, so a star would be like one 100 trillionth of the universe instead of saying that it has X amount of mass. It's just, and that's just this language thing that you were talking about earlier, how language comes into play. It's really the same thing. It's just how you're looking at it. And I think that that's a much better way of doing it, just a personal opinion, because the ether implies that there's some new substance, you know, especially the stuff from Michelson and Morley. Like the stuff from Michelson and Morley, the ether from the Michelson and Morley thing was like this rigid grid that that didn't move. And so it was like all of the matter in the universe was relative to the ether. But that's not that's not the modern day ether. The modern day ether is it's basically just particles of mass, like you said. And you know, that's fine. But I think it's much better to use a differential geometry at that level when you're talking about the fundamental nature of the universe, because it's all the same thing. Yeah. Like, you know, it's just what the thing is doing.
It's very, it just strikes me now that there is, again, something about which brain hemisphere you are thinking with, because the particle idea is very much a left hemisphere concept in itself. Like to find the essential bit or something, while thinking of it like this all mass, and it also then motion, and if it's the time, then you're thinking with the right hemisphere. And that's it's a whole different debate, but there's some just a bit with the McGilchrist work again, that much. Since science, like modernism and science, the last 500 years, the culture and the mentality has shifted very much onto the premises of the left hemisphere and left hemisphere thinking. And then that will, again, grasp for control and certainty and kind of small tangible instances as kind of the basic units. And it's not an argument in itself, but it can be an indication that, like, maybe if you try to think more in a holistic way with more like right hemisphere, where you would have, you can create different kinds of models or understanding or thoughts about what, for example, ether could be. But there's one thing from when I read about some of the ether. One thing that I liked about the idea was that this just resonates with me, that you can, if you've seen one of those infogram things where you have, it goes from the like the smallest like atoms or elementary particles, and it goes up to like molecules and then substances and this and that, and then the solar system and then the universe, like the whole cosmos. You have like from the smallest to the biggest, and I always, when I look at it, I just think like you can expand it infinitely in both directions. You can zoom out from the visible cosmos infinitely, and you can also zoom further down into the microcosmos infinitely. So what we think is, no matter what we think, now we finally understood the smallest part. I think you can, if you zoom in a trillion times, you will find something new. So it will be this idea of that it is fractal. Like it's like exploring a mathematical fractal. You can go forever. It will never stop. So that's, that will be.
Even the small scale too. Like this is, I seriously think this, like if you go small enough, like we're talking, you know, like trillion times smaller than the smallest known particle, then you know there may be other galaxies. I sincerely believe that. My friend Paul, he argues with me about this all the time. He says that there must be a fundamental building block, and I was like, yeah, but that fundamental building block can start from the middle. And he doesn't quite comprehend that. But
that's an interesting thought. I love it. And especially if you think of the middle as kind of a scale that is in our own image, like a scale that we are comfortable with. And then you can start there, and you can go up and down infinitely, because this is, well, that's what we are shaped to perceiving and thinking in our own scale primarily. So, but it's interesting when you mention your friend there, because that will be another example of kind of the battle of the hemispheres. Like, what kind of thinking are we using when we try to approach or engage with these deepest questions? And there's a very often very kind of strong, like the left hemisphere is the center of aggression as well. So when you threaten people's left hemispheric models of the world, poke at their axioms, they might be like strangely angry and aggressive. And that is how the left hemisphere works. So someone is really focused on that. I had a friend who was so sure that the brain is like a machine. And he was so angry if I said like, no, but there's more to how the brain works than just like a mechanical machine. There are other ways of using your brain. That was the same kind of response of anger. And now through reading more about the brain hemispheres, you can interpret that as being, again, like which brain are you using of your two brains? And just so much you're describing, it sounds like you're very good at going or using both. And that is,
yeah, I think that's an important thing, is that you do want to use both. Like there's like that last part that I just said about, you know, zooming into the smallest area, that right there, that's probably a left brain hemisphere thing. Mm-hmm. Like talking about the fractal nature, yeah, it appears that way when you're looking at it from the right brain sense, but it's, you know, it gets into the realm of who knows and unanswerable, and so that, you know, you have to use the left brain to kind of to work from there. Like who knows if there's galaxies that are, you know, smaller than atoms. I don't really know that, but, and you know, no, well, there's no way of ever knowing that, but it's kind of fun to explore. So you do have to use both left and right brain. It's kind of like, it's like a first, like it's important to use first principles, you know, like Elon Musk is so successful because like he understands first principles and put them in practice. Like he says that, you know, he'd say, okay, we have to get satellites into space. What's the best way to do this? Whatever, we're going to build our own rocket. Like he looks at the problem and then comes up with the right solution. And it's like, it doesn't matter what cultural element or impacts there are, or not just cultural, but there's all these other things that impact your decision making or problem solving. And you have to get rid of all that stuff and solve from the best, most practical, most obvious solutions. Yeah. You know, and all you have to do to change the mainstream cosmological thing is that, you know, there is no metric expansion.
Yeah.
In other words, like you'd have to say whatever about the redshift. You know, maybe it's just a mystery that you don't know, but you can't assume that the metric is expanding. Like there's some tensor or like that is, you know, non-Euclidean, it creates this non-Euclidean form that doesn't include, you know, in opposition of gravity. Like that's literally the opposite of what we would naturally assume. Like that sort of thing. It's not a first principle. Like that comes from nowhere, really. You know, like it ended up being that they were able to do lots of stuff with that because they didn't have to worry about the redshift. And so, you know, and maybe that was helpful in some ways, but the problem is that there's no fundamental reason for thinking that it's there. It's just, it's basically just saying like, when you're doing that, you're basically like the whole lambda paradigm, you're acknowledging the problem exists, but then you're giving you're adding a non-solution as a solution. So it's kind of like dark energy, the name term dark energy and dark matter. Yeah. Like they sound like solutions to the problem, but no, they're just restating the problem as a solution. It's kind of like the Jeopardy part. You know, it's kind of like Jeopardy. It's literally Jeopardy.
I keep getting this illustration of the epicircles for the Ptolemaic solar system, that the more observation they got of the planets, they invented more and more epicircles to make it all fit. And then they had this, like it was supposed to be, or they made that even as an argument that, oh, look at this, like the divine, there's a pattern here, like this kind of embroidery pattern of all these epicircles. And that was proof that it was even more divine because it was so kind of symmetrical and beautiful. So that's how inflation theory sounds to me as well. At the beginning, the universe suddenly expanded a lot faster just to get rid of the flat problem. But then even people like Roger Penrose is skeptical, and founders of the inflation theory are skeptical towards it. And they just invented it on the fly, and then it solves the problem.
Inflation is exactly...
Yeah,
it's exactly the same thing. It's just a restatement of the problem as a single word.
Yeah,
you know, because it's like, oh, it's like you have this math problem, and you have X. You're trying to solve for X. You don't know what X is, and then they say, oh, X is Billy Bob.
Yeah,
and you're like, okay, what does that mean? They're like, okay, this is what happens when you have Billy Bob, and then they just write out the formula that you just wrote.
Yeah,
and you're like, no, that's not. It's not Billy Bob. And they're like, yeah, it is. It's Billy Bob. Look.
Yeah,
and you're
exactly.
like, no, that's not Billy Bob. That's X.
Look at this observation. And that proves that Billy Bob is the reason.
Exactly. And so, you know, that's what blows my mind about A, the Big Bang Theory, B, inflation, the dark matter, dark energy, even the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is like, you know, they use it as a, they're like, oh, see, we were right about the Big Bang. We got the CMBR. And you're like, what?
Yeah.
Like it's just another mystery.
So, I read, since you mentioned Elon Musk, I just read something where he said the other day that we should strive towards being a multi-planetary species as soon as possible. Also in part so we can back up the biosphere in case a calamity on Earth happens. That we have made a backup somewhere. And this is interesting. This is big thinking. I like, it's very kind of engineering like thinking, but I really like it. It's like, that's a good point.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of people are like, well, there's nothing on Mars. Well, you could make Mars cool. Maybe we can make Mars cool. I don't know.
Not to switch topic entirely, but terraforming Mars could give us enormous insights into
and there may be easy ways of doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's good. And also just to add one other thing, when you said like the balance, with the thinking, just also this is for listeners, if you haven't heard about this before, but like how it's supposed to work with your two brain parts is that like both are essential, both are crucial, and they should just work together. But how it's supposed to work is that you perceive things with your right hemisphere. You take it in kind of unfiltered with your right hemisphere. Then things are moved to your left, which takes it apart, builds a model. And then the model is supposed to go back into your right hemisphere and be kind of integrated or unified with what you already know from earlier. So it's this constant kind of circle movement almost of how we observe and perceive and learn and integrate things. But the problem is that if things are too left brain tilted, you just create a model and then you don't unify it into anything. You just stay with the model forever. And then you stop seeing the world and reality. You just see the model. And this is a very common effect that people relate to their model of the world instead of the reality of the world. And if those are in conflict or contradicting each other, you get internal tension in people. Which happens with everybody. So it's just like being aware of it.
It's like a system of guessing and then assessing the guess.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, They kind of
go hand in hand, but that don't always mean the guessing is right. Sometimes it's wrong, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's still a good thing that it's still working, but sometimes they're in opposition.
Exactly.
But that is still working when they are in opposition, but you have to
guessing process of learning.
Guess until it's right, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, cool. So we covered a lot of stuff now. I think it's especially interesting some of the things like towards the end there, we're talking about the nature of waves, the ether, and gravity as well, and some about the thinking. Do you have any final words or kind of thoughts the next year or two, or your own work, where you're headed with things?
You know, my message is fairly simple. Like I've pretty well covered my message with you, especially over the course of the we've done three now, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so, you know, I think keeping it simple is the most important thing, because I think that it's really important people understand that there's definitely a way to show that gravitational redshift is can match up with Hubble's law, and it's a really super simple equation. Like it's this stuff is very simple. Yeah. If anybody's interested, then go to my website, theuniverseisnotexpanding.com. Mm-hmm. Try to keep it as simple as possible. I've also got a YouTube channel and things like that. But my name's Chris Brown on YouTube. So if anybody wants to look, you'd have to type. I don't know how you'll find it. Good luck. You know, it's probably. I would not use Rihanna Chris Brown as a.
I think if you just search for universe not expanding, you come up on several of the top 10 videos, I think.
Yeah. And so I would love that. If I had more subscribers, I would make more videos.
Yeah.
It's a little weird talking about myself too on video, and I should probably interview other people, but then that takes a lot of work is setting up interviews with people. But anyways, regardless, I think keeping it simple is the most important thing, because if you can show that there's an explanation for the redshift and that there's, and then the rest of this stuff, like the Mond paradigm is how you can show that there's a gravitational redshift. It's not just my ideas. Now, you know, Milton Mordenheim doesn't say this, but like it's still his work, this minimum acceleration that's coming from larger scale objects. This is going to create a gravitational redshift that is distance dependent. And so like it depends on the distance, which means that light tires with distance. And the rest of the stuff for the non-expanding paradigm is really kind of super simple, because the Mond thing plays into dark matter. Now, I don't think Mond is absolutely accurate for dark energy, but there's probably some other stuff that comes into it. But most of the major unsolved things kind of come together a little better. And so it's, you know, but I think it's also important not to ditch things like, you know, like special and general relativity or the other parts of mainstream physics. You know, there's a lot, even lots of stuff in cosmology can probably be salvaged, because the redshift was just accounted for within the paradigm. Yeah. And so, you know, if it's just gravity, then there should be a parameter or a, you know, like for that, like, so that, you know, you would have this, the paradigm would account for that redshift before you did anything else. So basically the work is the same, you know. Mm. It's just the interpretation that was wrong.
Yeah.
Which I think it's going to take a long time to unravel, and it's going to be a really tumultuous time period, but it'll probably be aggressive and brief once it happens. Yeah. I don't know what the trigger will be, and it may be this James Webb thing. I don't know. Yeah.
Well, it's like the when is the last drop, kind of. it could be hard to say, but I think you're right. And I just as being an open person who loves to learn stuff and explore stuff, I see the positive side of all of this, that we might have this new golden age of new science in cosmology that will be coherent as well. So when you pick up a cosmology book, it's not like you're reading one, two chapters and then you get into dark energy and dark matter, and like 95% of the universe is something we don't know what is, and you can't see it, we can't detect it, but it makes everything fit in our equations. Already there is kind of, this field is strange. So to sort this stuff out and just having really good sound science can be like exhilarating. It could be something really, really exciting and open up for just new huge areas and avenues of exploration. So that's kind of partly my enthusiasm for this, is that there's something much brighter and more interesting like lying in the future, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Big Bang Theory also has this giant impact on culture, just the people's interpretation of it. And it's, I think it's really negative. Honestly, it's this materialist view, you know, this idea that we had nothing at some point and then now we got this, and this is what we got. And that to me, it's like so limiting in nature. And you know, there's a lot of people that would disagree, like Sean Carroll would disagree with that assessment. But to me, the mystery in an infinite universe, is especially infinite in time, is so more exhilarating. Like, and there's so many more avenues that philosophy would want to explore, especially on a global level. You'd want multiple cultures to kind of assess that. But, you know, instead we have this on a global level. So basically all cultures, you know, they hear that science thinks that the universe is expanding. And so that you know, they use that and then have their own interpretation of what that means. That would all change, but it would take a long time. In other words, it's a paradigm shift, not just in science, but in culture too, to where it's kind of like the flat earth, when we went from flat earth to round earth, or the, you know, the geocentric model, or like, it just, like, it's pretty groundbreaking, honestly. It's a lot more impactful than someone like Sean Carroll would like to admit, though. That's why I wish they weren't so quick to say that it's expanding, because the default would be it's non-expanding. That's the default. Like, that's your baseline. And then you have this idea of what might have, you know, like, you could have these potentials, other potentials that are not the default. But the default is this non-expanding idea. And so when you imply some theory on that level, then you need to have a little bit of humility.
Yeah.
And they have not, the observations and the data do not reach I don't know how it can sustain their arguments for much longer.
But I was thinking about, like, the last 2 minutes about you mentioned before, humility, because this is an old medieval and ancient idea that humility is the key to learning and to discovery. And also to virtue in itself, like, for more like moral theological traditions. But it is the number one, like, the necessity, but also the key to the great things. And that's exactly what can get us out of this being stuck in a model. So, but that is a challenge in itself. It requires a bit of courage as well. It's partly a habit. Like, if you can think of, it's just, you can take it on a very base level. Like, we don't understand everything, and that's okay. That's kind of all you need as a starting point, instead of saying we know everything and there's no mysteries anymore, which is kind of logically not accurate either. So,
yeah, I mean, one of the things that science has done, it has stolen the magic from nature.
Yeah.
And you know, and it's not, there's no reason. Just because you give things names does not mean anything. Like,
it's interesting, like, the choice of words you're using here, because naming things is what the left hemisphere is doing, because it's a language center and the speaking center especially, but it names things to gain control over the world. And it operates exactly in the way that you described it, that as long as you just put a label on it, it creates a feeling of control over it. And then it's sorted. And then what happens is that you don't see the reality, you just see the label and the word. And then you don't go beyond it, like that specific name you put on it. So it's just one more of the countless traps of having a cultural problem of a two left hemispheric mentality as well. So
like, if you were able to show, say, a smartphone to someone from the 200 years ago, you were able to just, you could go back in time and you pulled out your phone and showed it to them. At first, that smartphone would be this giant mysterious thing. Say you just handed it to them, you turned it on, you gave it to them and walked away. And for a while, they would be so super fascinated with that. But eventually they'd be like, oh, it would just be its thing, and it wouldn't be that big of a deal. They wouldn't even know how to
use it. It goes straight into so many imbalance philosophies and all of that as well. Suddenly I'm thinking about, this is way on the side again, but like, Well, just the idea that when you start defining things into detail, you are you're removing the mystery and the magic, as we said, but you're also replacing something big and mysterious with something that is very reductive. And you might think that it is a representation that is that covers what you try to think about, but it's not. It's a very, very reductive representation. And that's a huge trap for limiting yourself, and also for but just in general, you limit yourself, but you're also removing so many of the best things in the world and in life and the experience of life. So
I think we're just fascinated by novelty. Like, novelty for humans is just this, it's like the peak of fascinating things.
Yeah.
And novelty only lasts for a certain amount of time, because really there's endless amount of novelty on planet Earth. Mm. It's just, we, you know, and if you don't believe that, like if you don't believe that there's an endless amount of novelty on planet Earth, then I would encourage you to pack a backpack full of all the necessary things and hike miles into a wilderness and walk around and look at the tiny little things on the ground floor and in the trees and not just at nighttime, just all the time. Just take a close look at nature. If you have to eat some mushrooms to do that, then whatever. But like the nature of our universe is so incredibly fascinating that it shouldn't be ignored just because we have all these scientific explanations, quote unquote, you know.
I love it. I think we're going to let that be the last word, because that was so beautifully put, and I agree 100%. And just let the mystery and the wonder of nature be kind of the lasting thought after this conversation. So I hope we can talk again later, maybe in a few months, maybe when Jim Webb has sent us some new pictures, and then we can have another update.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Yeah, I am excited about what this year is going to bring on that front. So just want to say thank you so much.
Just real quickly, I wanted to mention this one about James Webb, that they've already got enough data from it to do another measurement of Hubble's law, and it was like just slightly higher, which I found interesting, that it was like 73 kilometers a second per megaparsec or something.
Well, I think the calibration has gone really, really well, so it's so that's good. So it's kind of, it's promising that it's going to function really well. So but I just want to say thank you so much again for taking the time. It's a huge joy to talk with you. And also to all the listeners, thank you so much for joining us and listening for this episode. And see you again in another episode. Bye-bye.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.